Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to another episode of Freeform, a world that just might work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Pulitzer Prize winners Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn about their latest book, Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope. After a three-year hiatus since Trump's Electoral College victory, I've been doing a new interview every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on No Is Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on Strangers in Their Own Land and the Stories That Divide Us, Robert Wright on Why He's a Buddhist. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts available anytime, anywhere, Apple Podcasts and most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. Quick plug for participation. I've been giving out these websites for the last 3 years. Now, of course, we're into electoral season, but still, let me let you know, indivisible.us.com.org. Indivisible is probably the most national active organization for participation, and they have like 5,000 groups in local communities. MoveOn.org, that's one word, MoveOn.org, and Courage Campaign, that's two words, CourageCampaign.org, are two digital participation sites that work closely with the grassroots. Courage Campaign in California, MoveOn nationally. Five Calls, the number five in the word calls.org, tells you calls that you might need to make to your representatives on a timely and relevant basis. And Town Hall Project, one word, Town Hall Project, tells you when your representatives are going to be in town, when you can actually meet them and talk with them in person. Now to today's conversation. I admire my two guests today, Nick Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn, and I admire what they've taken on in their new book, Tightrope. Stick around. I think that we're going to touch a lot of bases that really matter in the next hour. The authors tell their story in part through the lives of some of the children with whom Kristof grew up in rural Yamhill, Oregon, an area that prospered for much of the 20th century but has been devastated in the last few decades, as have so many parts of America, as blue-collar jobs disappeared. Get this fact, about one quarter of the children on Kristof's old school bus died in adulthood from drugs, alcohol, suicide, or reckless accidents, what they call deaths of despair. The book, and most of their work, delivers on a lot of levels. They tell deeply personal stories. In Tightrope, these are not just personal in the sense that we meet real people, but as I said, these are personal to Nick and Cheryl. Then they supply context. Where have we gotten to, and how did we get here? They talk policy. What policies produced our gross inequality and our tribal divisions? And what policies might help us heal? And finally, they deal with the power of narrative and the need for a new American story to replace the up by your bootstraps, you're on your own narrative, with one that recognizes that the people of our nation need each other. Nicholas Kristof, an op-ed columnist for the New York Times, was previously Times bureau chief in Hong Kong, Beijing, and Tokyo. He won a Pulitzer in 2006 for his columns on Darfur. Cheryl Wu Dunn, who now works in banking, was a business editor at the New York Times and a foreign correspondent in Tokyo and Beijing. Together, they were awarded a Pulitzer Prize in 1990 for their coverage of China. They have co-authored several books, including A Path Appears, Half the Sky, and their latest, the one we're talking about today, Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope. Welcome, Nick Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
Thank you, Terrence.
Great to be here, Terrence.
Okay, and let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Friday, February 21st. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So a bit about where you each come from. Now, I know one thing I want to touch on in light of what's going on in this country today. You're both the children of immigrants. You're in your families. Am I correct? You are both the first generation born in the U.S. Nick, first, where did your family come from? How did they get here?
So my mom's side has been in the U.S. Forever, but my dad was born and grew up in Eastern Europe in a place that periodically changed its flag. So he could call himself Romanian, Ukrainian, Polish, and he was a World War II refugee. And survived a concentration camp, settled in France initially, and then thought that that the place he might find greater opportunity would be in the United States.
Okay, and Cheryl, how about yourself?
So, well, my mom came from Canada, so if you count that as an immigrant, but both grandparents came from China. We actually were really, they were peasants in China, in southern Guangdong province, and they made the harrowing trip over to the U.S. and to Canada, and here I am.
Okay, and in terms of your personal path, one quick question is, I'd always assumed that the two of you met at Harvard, but that's not the case, is it? When and how did your paths intersect?
It's actually kind of funny. We were both journalists in Los Angeles covering business. I was a New York Times reporter doing so, and Cheryl was doing so for the Wall Street Journal. And so we had this romance that was steeped in secrecy. It was a little bit like a CIA-KGB romance, and neither of us could talk about anything either of us was working on.
Well, I'm not sure who would be the KGB in that instance.
But that's how it all began.
Okay. And then for each of you, kind of your paths to Nick first, you to journalism, to the New York Times, and Cheryl, because we've already laid out that both of you come from, you know, not exactly the elite college families. And then Cheryl, your path after that. So, Nick.
So I grew up in this, you know, beloved little farm town called Yamhill in rural Oregon, population about 1,000 on a good day. And my, you know, my school basically never sent anybody to any university out of state. But I applied to Harvard, was accepted, and went there without ever having visited the campus. I began in journalism because when I turned 16 and could get my driver's license, I wrote to the editor of the county paper and said, give me a job. And so he hired me, and so I worked every day after school as a reporter, and I just loved it. I couldn't believe that I was being paid to talk to people and write articles. And so I continued. I studied law after college, and I was in some danger of becoming a law professor, but I escaped that fate and joined the New York Times in 1984.
Very good. And Cheryl?
Well, I grew up in Manhattan, sort of the farthest you can get from Yamhill, Oregon.
Truly.
But my parents really, it was part of the American dream. My dad, you know, grew up when working in a Chinese restaurant. That's what my grandfather opened, a Chinese restaurant. What else? And, you know, waiting tables and all sorts of stuff. And then he got into college at Georgia Tech and did architecture and came to New York to help build buildings, civil engineering. And my mom came with him to New York. And so I grew up on the Upper West Side, went to Cornell University, and was not planning to go into journalism. In fact, a history professor I had, when I was asking, well, what do you do with a history degree? He goes, you can go into journalism. And I looked at him as though he was from Mars. I thought, why on earth would I want to go into journalism? I was a biology major. So that tells you how good prediction you know, capabilities I have. And then I went to graduate school, got married to Nick, and he was posted in China. And when we got to China, there were not too many things to do. China was very communist at that time. And, you know, someone said, oh, you can actually start a business in communist China. And I sort of thought, well, that would be really hard. and anyway, I started stringing for the New York Times. Even that was hard because it was hard to get credentials from the Chinese authorities, even at that time. And finally, I was able to do that and then started writing for the Times.
Very good. Okay, so how did you come to write books together? Now the paths have intersect. You have married. You're both working, and then you decide we're going to work on a book. I, by the way, have co-written scripts and co-written books with my partner, so I know that some of the challenges.
Well, actually, it started out at when we were in China. You know, we were foreign correspondents in the same bureau, of course, and it really helped in China because that place, even back then, was extremely hard to operate in. We were followed all the time and, you know, very worried about getting our sources in trouble, and that was a lot of pressure put on us. And in fact, in the last year that we were there, one of our rivals got her best source and best Chinese friend sent to jail for 10 years and his wife for 4 years. So that was a huge pressure cooker. And when we came out, there was so much more that we wanted to say that we couldn't write in the Times, and so we put it into a book together. And that sort of began the partnership.
Okay. How much time have you spent, do you spend, in Yamhill these days or over the last few years?
Well, my mom is still on the family farm,
right.
So we go back regularly to visit her, to visit friends, and we're also, you know, managing the farm long distance, so that brings us back. So we, and actually, a number of the books we've written on the farm, taken a break and written them there. So we've, over the years, you know, we've continued to spend time there. We love it. Cheryl is now an honorary Yamhill citizen.
Sure.
So we do get back quite a bit.
Okay, yeah, I did want to set that up so that people don't think, oh, they dropped in, you know, to their old hometown. No, this is some place where you actually, as you say, you've written a lot of your books on that farm. So you're living there. You're doing, you know, you're doing these other books. You're doing what you're doing. When is it that you realize there's something going on here that needs further exploring and ends up in this book?
Well, you know, at first it was just more kind of seeing a tragedy, seeing friends arrested, in particular for meth possession or manufacturing meth or other drug offenses. Then it was seeing families collapse. This is a community that had had traditionally a very tight social fabric, and it unraveled. And then seeing friends die early. And, you know, for a while, we just couldn't process it. What was going on? Was there something about this bus or this town? And then I think what really hit us was seeing mortality data from across the U.S. and realizing that, no, this isn't one community. This is a demographic. This is America's working class that is imploding, and that people are dying of deaths of despair from drugs, alcohol, and suicide at high enough rates to bring down life expectancy for the United States as a whole. For 3 years in a row, which hadn't happened for 100 years. You know, even in the Great Depression, life expectancy actually rose quite strongly. But now, in communities like Yamhill, there's such an impact on life expectancy, such devastation that it affects overall American mortality rates. And that was when, you know, we realized that this is really something that has damaged the United States as a whole, has damaged American competitiveness, and that we wanted to write about it through a community that I dearly love.
Okay. And, I mean, just to back up that the research on some research that you cite by Deaton and Case points out that while the macro, the life expectancy of America is going down, it's going down particularly among one set of American citizens.
That's right.
Actually,
I mean,
when they looked at census data, and for most categories in the census, the mortality rate is falling, life expectancy is rising. But for basically working-class Americans, that mortality rate is rising, their life expectancy is falling. And it's not happening anywhere else in our peer countries. It's not like it's a global trend. It is really something that the U.S. is an outlier in.
Okay, and as one other thing I've heard you point out is that even though last year was the first year in four that life expectancy didn't continue to fall, in among those classes, it was getting no better.
It's getting a little bit better. I think that's partly because now there is a huge amount of focus on the opioids crisis, and they're predicting that next year also will be a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
But there is this inevitable, reinforced that the opioid crisis is really plaguing America, and that trend really is very strong.
Right. And,
and likewise, suicide rates are at a high since World War II. Alcohol deaths continue to rise. And alcohol actually kills more Americans than drugs, although we often aren't aware of that.
Because alcohol affects the body in so many ways that there are things which the upstream cause is alcohol.
That's right. And, I mean, in particular, it's cirrhosis of the liver and liver cancer that are a consequence of drinking too much.
Right, where they won't list that on your death certificate, but alcohol is what killed you.
That's right. I mean, they'll list liver cancer or they'll list cirrhosis as a cause of death.
Yeah. Okay, so let's, this has both the personal and the much bigger, but to get back to the personal, could you tell us what happened to the Knapps and the Greens, families that you rode that bus with every day?
So the five Knapp kids got on the bus every day right after I did. They lived just down the road. And Farlan, the oldest kid, was my year. He was a very smart, talented kid. His brother Zeelan, his brother Nathan, his brother, baby brother Keelan, and their sister Regina. And they were all talented kids and kind of full of hope. Their dad laid sewer pipe, at a good union job. And with that job, he'd been able to afford to buy a home. Their mother worked on a nearby hazelnut farm, and they earned a good enough income that when Farlan turned 16, the family scrimped and saved and bought him a Ford Mustang. And so we were all jealous of Farlan. But then the kinds of jobs that their dad and mom had left and moved away and just didn't pay anything like as well as they had. And Farlan was fired from his job. He went in a downward spiral. He self-medicated with drugs and alcohol. He died of liver failure as a consequence of drug and alcohol use. Zeelan died in a house fire when he was passed out drunk. Nathan blew himself up cooking meth. Regina died of hepatitis from injecting drugs. And the only survivor among the five kids was the baby, Keelan, and he survived because he was spending 13 years in the Oregon State Penitentiary, which was somewhat protective. And the next generation has also been affected, that the next generation, Farland's daughter died at 29. She basically drank herself to death. His other daughter is in prison right now for drug offenses. And they were somewhat unusual, but they were not alone. There was another family you mentioned on the bus also with five kids, the Green family. I was particularly close to them. I ran track with Kevin Green. His brother Clayton was a good friend. Their sister Cindy was my year in school. And four of those five are now gone as well. And their dad had been a cement finisher who helped build the Fremont Bridge across the Willamette River in Portland. It was, again, a good union job that had let them buy their own house, buy their farm. And none of the kids could get jobs, anything like that. And so four of the five are now gone.
Wow. Let me just let people take that in from those two families. And that's Yam Hill. You then traveled around the country and found that the same thing is happening and has happened all over. Yes?
That's right. Cheryl can weigh in but this is from Maine to Appalachia and also in African American communities like Baltimore, Arkansas. The commonality is essentially class and educational opportunity more than race. In fact, African Americans in many ways went through this 20 years earlier when jobs left inner cities like Baltimore. And in fact, the public response was much harsher then, and it was all about lock people up for drug possession. Now there is some slightly greater compassion and empathy as more working class whites fall into that category. But this is a essentially national problem. It's less geographic than it is demographic, based on people who do not have a college degree.
Mm-hmm. Let's,
and
let's,
I think it's
go ahead, Cheryl,
important
yeah.
to point out that, you know, it may not be the case that, you know, everyone knows someone who's, you know, 4 out of the 5 kids
yeah.
have, you know, not made it. But there is an issue of morbidity. There are people who are struggling in the family. They may have addictions, or they may actually be homeless. Or they may be struggling with something, partly because they haven't been able to make it in America. And so this phenomenon, you know, whether you're not, the death of despair, those are the extremes, but just the struggling from despair. So
right.
it's related to alcoholism or addiction or, you know, depression and loneliness. I mean, even loneliness itself, scientists say, is the equivalent of smoking about 15 cigarettes a day. It has a lethality about it as well. So there really is a, at least in the U.S., an epidemic that is afflicting the lower class.
Yeah, an epidemic of loss of opportunity and then the path to despair. I want to talk a little bit about the role of race in all of this. The good old days of the early post-war years included the GI Bill, the interstate highway system, and other national initiatives that supported a middle class. But those good old days excluded most people of color. Both of my high schools in Florida, I'm 71, so I was in high school in the late 60s. Both of my high schools in Florida were integrated while I was there. You know, that's a reality. No sooner had we passed civil rights legislation than Nixon came up with his Southern strategy. And can you tell the story of how that helped lead us to the deaths of despair that you write about now among people of color and poor whites?
Yeah, so I think that's actually really important. I think there were two narratives that emerged around that time that helped lay the groundwork for this. And one was, as you mentioned, Nixon's Southern Strategy beginning in 1968, which involved essentially racializing the issue of benefits, of social welfare programs, of investing in human capital. And those stigmatized those programs, and so as a result, the U.S. Substantially underinvested in these kinds of programs compared to our peer countries. And the other concurrent narrative that emerged around the same time was Reagan's notion that government is always part of the problem, that it just cannot help. People have to rely just on themselves or on their own bootstraps. And I think those two narratives together resulted in a huge underinvestment in human capital in America. We invented mass high school attendance. We were number one in the country in high school graduation. We were the first country in the world to have a large number of people who went to college. And then in the period after that, so many other countries surpassed us. So now we're sort of the bottom of the G7 countries in those respects. Since the late 1980s, we've actually become more segregated by race and education. So we integrated for a while, and then based on geography, schools became more segregated again. And I think that was the racialization of these issues. One reason there was not as much empathy as there might have been for people who were struggling. And one reason there were fewer programs, one reason there was this effort to lock people up through mass incarceration rather than provide, for example, drug treatment.
And there were the benefits and the policies that would have helped people in the bottom were denigrated as helping the other. So
that's right.
So we didn't have them. What that meant was that we didn't have them in place when the pain hit the white working class.
That's right. And yeah, I mean, and it was indeed those parts of the country that were most divided on race and where the racialization of benefits were the greatest, particularly the South, where, as a result, there was, in particular, less investment in public education and worse outcomes in education and health, and that obviously hurt Black Americans, but it also hurt white Americans and hurt the entire states there. You know, there's a reason that tech companies are not competing to open up offices in Mississippi or Alabama. It's because they don't; those states don't have human capital right now, and they don't have an environment that companies want to base themselves in. Rather, they simply appealed for a while to factories that wanted very little regulation, that wanted no unions, and for a while that strategy worked a little bit, but it ran out. And so those states are now an economic mess. They've been losing ground vis-a-vis the rest of the country, and it was in some ways because of because we blinded ourselves partly because of race and didn't invest in American kids.
Yeah, we're going to talk more about kids, but there's something that you talk about that I think is worth reminding people. You've said that there were two narratives that seem to emerge that have really had an awful lot to do with what gets passed in this country and what's acceptable in this country and what's aspirational in this country for the last 50 years. One is you're on your own, and two is government's the problem. And yet you point out, I love this this particular example, that the Oregon Trail, which everyone knows about, that brought people to where you grew up, there was a carrot at the end of that Oregon Trail.
That's right. People didn't just those pioneers didn't just cross the country just for the heck of it. They crossed the country and took that risk because of a government benefit program for the disadvantaged, and that was the Homestead Program. Initially in Oregon, people got 640 acres if they got to the Willamette Valley. Later, under the Federal Homestead Acts, they got 160 acres. And as part of those Homestead Acts, there was always land reserved for schools, for education. I mean, it was an incredibly, you know, it was one quarter of American adults can owe part of their family wealth to the Homestead Acts. It was a program that you know, created a vast amount of wealth and put people on a track toward the middle class. And that was a government. And likewise, places like Yamhill were transformed later through rural electrification, through the GI Bill of Rights. And, you know, they were often discriminatory, but they certainly, for disadvantaged white Americans, they created a lot of opportunity.
It's very interesting that we conveniently forget when we have received a subsidy that we actually did something all on our own, not because of the incentive that originally was set up for us. And likewise, a lot of it's what's sad about is that people have at least internalized a lot of this, you know, personal responsibility narrative, such that, you know, if they didn't you know, get out of their rut, it's their fault, and therefore it's only their fault because they have to account for their own responsibility. But the problem with that is that it's very demoralizing for a lot of people, and they also don't recognize that when they're taking food stamps or when they're actually taking Section 8 voucher housing or when they're taking Medicaid, those have a stigma attached to them. But for some reason, when more wealthier Americans take the mortgage deduction, or when we get the deduction to buy a yacht plane, or we get, you know, we get property tax breaks when we buy a condo in New York City for $200 million and pay the property tax as if it's only $9 million, that's not a subsidy that is stigmatized. It's really warped.
It, very much so. And one thing I want to emphasize that you pointed out is that I mentioned how these belief systems, these narratives, influence policy choices. But what you're saying is, of course, yeah, that's true on the macro level. But individually, the guilt, the self-denigration, all of that, the loss of self-respect that comes with failure when that's your ideology, when that's your myth.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's really important. We think that the sort of the Horatio Alger miss will galvanize people at the bottom. And there are probably some cases where that is true, where, you know, somebody hears some inspiring story and is inspired to take a risk and work incredibly hard, and that's great. But I think that very often the opposite happens. And what I saw with many of my friends was that, in particular, they compared themselves to their dads.
Of course.
The men did. And they could not do as well as their dad. Their dads have been able to get good union jobs and earn a good sort of middle-class living, and they could not. And they had absorbed and internalized these narratives, and they blamed themselves. Their self-esteem plummeted. They became socially isolated. They didn't have institutions that maybe in the Great Depression might have buffered those problems. They weren't a part of churches or other community organizations that might have provided a sense of identity and support. And so they kind of sank into a miasma of depression and self-medicated with alcohol or drugs in ways that made them less employable and less marriageable.
And, Terrence, this is not something that's just a tiny segment of the population. The effects of these policies have really broad implications. So in the 1950s, for instance, there was so much mobility such that, you know, 80 to 90% of people, when they reached the age of 40, they knew that they would be better off than their parents were.
Right.
You know, 80 to 90%, they had a better life. They would fork out a better life. Now, that number has dropped to 50%. So that means 50% of people actually will do better than their parents, and 50% will not. I mean, that's a huge change in upward mobility.
Yeah, and that other one, the consistency of the upward mobility had just been taken for granted. It was every generation, and this has broken that. Just as we talked about the life expectancy, you know, it had always been going up, and now it's broken.
That also has consequences, I think, for our liberalism as a society. You know, I sometimes wonder why it is that in the 1960s, we as a society were able, however grudgingly, to pass landmark civil rights legislation, whereas today there's a lot of demonization of immigrants in particular, but also other minority groups. And I think part of the answer is that in the 1960s, the white working class was reasonably confident that its children would do better than the parents had done. There was some optimism about the future, and that led people to be a little more willing to make room at the table, to be inclusive. And today, I think there are an awful lot of Americans who don't have that optimism, and as a result, are less inclusive, less willing to make room at the table, and more inclined to make scapegoats of people whom they can otherwise.
Let me tell people, by the way, this is Freeform, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn about the ideas, the stories, the pain, and the hope in their new book, Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope. One of the things I like about your approach is how much you emphasize the power of this narrative. So let's talk to us a little bit, because I'm sure you have gotten, I assume, some pushback from people who say you are blaming the personal responsibility narrative. But where would we be without personal responsibility, et cetera, et cetera? So can you speak to that?
Yeah. And look, I mean, personal responsibility is real. I mean, there's no question that people make bad choices that compound their problems. And, you know, there is a risk that if we don't acknowledge the effect of bad choices, that we, you know, rob people of agency, which is real. And it is also striking that that drug treatment programs or alcoholism programs, that one of the things they always emphasize is that people have to take responsibility for their own decisions. But having said that, you know, if we're going to have that conversation about personal responsibility, we also have to have a conversation about our collective responsibility and about things that we can do to mitigate that. So if you think that a baby, for example, a newborn in Union County, Florida, has a life expectancy shorter than a baby in Cambodia. Now, that is not because that baby is making bad choices,
right,
or has shown a lack of personal responsibility. It's because that baby is in an environment where he or she may later make some bad choices and is not going to get help. And if you know, there's some analogy I think to be made with driving. There's no doubt that there are an awful lot of auto accidents that are a consequence of irresponsible behavior. You know, people text while driving. They drink and they drive. They drive too fast. They get distracted. And so we could say, well, you know, we got to teach people a lesson. Let's put spikes in dashboards. That'll teach them. You know, instead we require airbags, seatbelts, padded dashboards, lit roads. We do everything we can to mitigate the irresponsibility that we know that people will show. And yet, in other contexts, particularly those involving people of low income, we don't do that. Instead, we think it's important that they suffer and to teach them a lesson. And I find that a colossal collective failure of responsibility, as of our responsibility as a society.
Okay. You place a great deal of importance on the role of work and jobs. Okay. And I actually wrote down this, which I think you'll agree with. I wrote lose job and then, you know, kind of like an equation, lose healthcare, lose your role, lose meaning, lose self-respect, lose relationships, lose hope. And now you're on the pathway to that death of despair.
Exactly. No, that's a perfect diagram I can see with the arrows.
Yeah.
I think that what, you know, so we had Andrew Yang in the Democratic debates talk about the universal basic income to actually put a floor on a lot of the pain that people are feeling. And so, you know, that is, you know, part of a good solution, but it isn't the only one, partly because, you know, a job is more meaningful than just the income that it brings in. And a universal basic income wouldn't actually give someone the meaning and the mission and the purpose that a job, you know, does give to people. We were just talking to one of the people who we interviewed in Tightrope recently when we were back in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been a construction worker all his life. And he is a Trump supporter, you know, and he is feeling a lot of, you know, pain from, you know, some, you know, backaches that he's had over the years. But he also doesn't have a job. And, you know, he, you know, basically was saying that I've done construction all my life. I mean, how could I do anything else?
Mm.
And I think that that identity with being a construction worker is really important when people lose their jobs. And so that's what's been happening in the manufacturing industry. You know, I've been a manufacturing worker all my life, and how could I change? But I think what we need to do better in this country is really address that attitude and also the concept of retraining and job retraining. Other countries have been hit by globalization and automation. They've lost lots of manufacturing jobs, but they retrain those workers because they have developed this concept of constant retraining. That retraining is good for you. It helps you. You can move ahead and become more resilient. And let me just explain just one comparison that really could shed some light.
That, by the way, Cheryl, that was going to be my very next question. You were on to it. The comparison between Detroit and Windsor, Ontario. Yep.
Exactly. well, after the financial crisis, when the automakers laid off a lot of auto workers, we saw what happened because they laid off workers in Detroit as well as in Windsor, Ontario, Canada, often the same automaker. And so what happened in the U.S. was that these people, they got a little bit more of extended unemployment benefits because it was a special situation, but they lost their job and they also lost their health care, which was a huge stressor on the family life. And then over in Windsor, Canada, what happened was, yes, they lost their job, but Canada has universal health care, so they did not lose their health care. So that meant that takes away a huge stressor on life. But also the government kicked in to action and said, let's look to find out where these people can be replaced or retrained to be replaced. And they put them, I mean, placed in another entity. And they found that nursing had a huge demand. So they actually created nursing programs to retrain these auto workers. These are welders, you know, and other sort of, you know, auto technicians, and, you know, for the nursing field. And look, I'm sure that a lot of auto workers weren't thrilled about it, but they still got jobs. And the result is that years later, there wasn't the issue of self-medication, loneliness, depression, that, you know, a lot of the workers here in the U.S. who didn't ever find jobs again, you know, that's what they suffered.
Right. And as we pointed out, if a job also gives you meaning, also gives you a feeling of self-worth, then, you know, you'll get over that. I'm no longer a construction worker or an auto worker, because those other things will fill you with the things that you need to carry on.
Exactly. So yeah. I think this country needs to do a better job at retraining. We always belittle retraining and say, oh, those things never work. Well, actually, they do work in other countries very well because they take them seriously. I mean, retraining is a serious enterprise. You have to do it well. It's not, oh, here's a two-week program,
right,
you know, and what has to happen is you work with local employers to find out what they need, and then you create the training program around that so that these people would be much more ready to go into those industries.
I'm afraid I've got to bow out now, but I'll leave you in Charles' very good hands.
Wonderful. Thank you, Nick. And I know you're working on this Sunday's column, so I look forward to seeing it. Okay.
Yeah. Take care.
Cheryl, so we will carry on together.
Yes.
One thing I want to mention, by the way, is that Cheryl and Nick will be appearing the 26th at the Aretani Theater downtown to talk about Tightrope. And the event is a part of the Allowed program of the Los Angeles Public Library Foundation. So if you go to Los Angeles Public Library Foundation or you go to Allowed, you can find information about this, and you'll get a chance to see the two of them in person dealing with these issues, which I would imagine, you know, a lot of you have thoughts about and feelings about. We were just talking about how other countries do this differently. Germany is excellent on retraining, and they have been for years. It's kind of part of their culture. Most countries, of course, do much better than us on healthcare, which is such an essential piece of this. In other words, in that crisis, in that financial crisis, people from all sorts of countries lost their jobs, but the Americans were the ones who also lost their healthcare.
Exactly.
Drug treatment. Portugal decriminalized drugs, and it has been successful. So I want you to take a moment, if you will, to talk about Portugal and that. And then here's my other question. Why is it so hard for Americans to learn from other countries?
Yeah, great question. So basically in the 1970s and the 1980s, America actually took a different path from other Western Europe countries, including and especially Portugal when it came to drugs. So in the U.S., what we did was we had the war on drugs in the mid-1980s. We passed these two major pieces of legislation that basically said if you're a small bit-time drug user and drug trafficker, and this is small bit-time, we're not talking about drug cartels, you can be thrown into jail. And we talk about in Tightrope a woman, Geneva Cooley, who she was addicted to drugs for years, and she was living in New York, and she took a train to Alabama to meet a friend, and then she was carrying a small bag of drugs, and she got caught. She was thrown into jail for 999 years without parole. Meanwhile, we have other large pharmaceutical companies who, at the time, were actually plying doctors with opioid prescriptions, trying to boost more subscriptions, getting far more people addicted to drugs and then therefore triggering far more deaths related to drugs than poor Geneva Cooley could. But none of them have, the executives, except for one company and one or two executives, have been prosecuted. Instead, they're, you know, sitting with billions of dollars in the bank accounts. So we took a different approach from Portugal, which at around the same time said, wait a second, incarcerating people like Geneva Cooley, you know, that doesn't solve the problem. What they really need is drug treatment. And so we're going to use the public health toolkit rather than the prison toolkit, and we're actually going to give these people drug treatment. And at the time, we didn't know which method would be the best.
Right,
because
it's an experiment.
People worry, oh my goodness, if you have safe injection sites, that's going to create more people wanting to do drugs. Well, in fact, it turns out that Portugal was right, and so their drug use, heroin use, has fallen by 2/3. They are they have the lowest number of overdose drug-related deaths in Western Europe, and it's pretty clear that that was the right approach. And there are many people in the U.S. who understand that that is the right approach. It's changing those laws that has been very, very difficult. We have great treatment centers in a few of the cities. In Tightrope, we write about a program called Women in Recovery in Tulsa, Oklahoma, that basically diverts women from long prison sentences if the cause of their criminality is related to an addiction. Then they will say, hey, come to our drug treatment program. It's a long commitment. It's 16 months, every single day, 10, 12 hours a day. But, it's intense therapy. You're going to go through an incredible program. But we'll give you an apprenticeship. And at the end, we have a lot of employers who are willing to hire ex-felons. And you'll become a productive member of society with a job and save millions of dollars in prison costs. In fact, over the period of this program, WEAR, Women in Recovery, has saved $70 million in prison costs in Tulsa.
Okay, so that second question that I tagged on at the end, why do you guys feel it's so hard for Americans to learn from other countries? I by the way, I wondered as I was writing this morning, is it another form of you're on your own to solve your own problems and on a, just writ large on a national scale that, that we got to do this ourselves? What do you think lies behind
it? No, Terrence, I think you're really very perceptive, because I think that part of it is that narrative. Part of it is also that we don't think we should be at a national, sort of congressional level. There's this view that why should we be shelling out, hard-won dollars to people who basically made mistakes themselves? And to that, we say, if you look at the people that, for instance, Nick referenced, a baby born in, in a certain zip code will have, you can predict it, two decades later that he's going to have trouble. In fact, there are zip codes where, the life expectancy is lower than for infants in Bangladesh or Cambodia. And so can you really be blaming that person? We write about a person in Tightrope where, he's homeless, he's addicted to drugs, and in Washington, D.C., and, we started asking him, well, how did you get to the state? Well, it turned out, he goes, it's all my fault. I've made so many bad decisions, it's all my fault. And then he proceeds to tell us that, well, at age 3, he watched as his brother was shot in the head, and then at age 5, he was shot in the head, but he survived. Then he found out that he had lead poisoning, and it was one after the other, such that if any one of us were in that situation, we would wonder how we could survive. And so someone like him, there's nothing wrong with giving a little nudge, because you never know, what you're going to find. And talent really is everywhere. It's universal, but opportunity is not. And so we may have baby Einsteins around the country, but nowadays, we have a baby born every 15 minutes with exposure to opioids. That really we need to change that.
The book does say Reaching for Hope. I know I've listened to you guys in interviews before, and you both say that you're hopeful, you're optimistic. What are the solutions? And I'm going to ask you two things. One, policy. Two, narrative.
Right. Okay, well, first of all, we are at a great time because there is so much innovation when it comes to policy tools going on across the country. Research universities have created all sorts of randomized controlled trials to evaluate what works and what doesn't work. And then there's a lot of experimentation going on across the country. So Women in Recovery is one example. It's privately funded by philanthropy, but they want to get 10 years of data so they can say, hey, this is something worth scaling because it works. And that's what we're in the process of seeing, is that there are solutions for so many different things. And so we just have to pick and choose and figure out which are the ones that are worthy of scaling. And so that's why it's very exciting, because people around the country recognize we have some great problems, and they've undertaken the task of trying to figure out how to come up with solutions.
And so, I've heard you say before three kind of peak areas of solution, right?
Okay, so if you want to focus on three areas, one is early childhood education, which is really important, especially for those babies, for instance, you know, that are born with drugs in their system. You know, the early phase of a baby's life is the most important, from 0 to 5 years, for instance, where their brain is developing at the fastest rate it will ever develop in their lifetime. And, you know, in all of our lifetimes, when we're babies, that's the critical phase. And so if, you know, we don't reach them in that early phase, if they have adverse childhood experiences at that phase, they're going to be hurt and impaired. Their brain development will be impaired. We always think that children are so resilient.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, they're very vulnerable. And when their brain is growing quickly, if they have the stress hormone cortisol coursing through their brain because, oh, in the home it's chaotic, there's violence, there's abuse, there's yelling and screaming all the time, that's going to promote cortisol coursing through their brain. And cortisol impairs the development of the brain architecture. So this is real. And if kids have more than, you know, we each have one or two ACEs, you know, our parents get divorced, or we have, there's a big move, you know, of the family. But if it starts to pile up, you know, 5, 6, 7 ACEs, then that kid is going to have difficulty later on. It's not just, oh, they're not going to graduate from high school. It's going to be that, you know, they will have later on heart disease more likely. They are more likely to have chronic diseases like diabetes. These have huge implications for healthcare costs, court costs in to our society.
You referred to ACEs.
You referred to ACEs, but
we hadn't identified what that is. Could you tell people what that is? ACEs.
ACEs is adverse childhood experiences.
Okay, and I've done some study of this myself, and I saw it. It was not in a psychological or an emotional context. It was in strictly, as you were referring to at the end there, health consequences that your lifetime health path may be defined by those ACEs you suffer in child if they're not dealt with. I think the drug war and mass incarceration is another one of your solutions.
Yes. So certainly drug treatment is really critically important to basically transform these people who are addicted to drugs into more productive human beings. And we've seen it happen. You know, women in recovery is one, you know, typical example. And, you know, it basically takes women like Rebecca Hale, who has been in and out of jail all their lives, you know, addicted to drugs, just not, you know, into helping the kids that they were supposed to raise, you know, being engaging in just terrible relationships, you know, abusive relationships. She got into Women in Recovery, and she was so committed to making it work. And she graduated from the program much earlier than normal. I think it was like 12 months. She completed it so quickly. And she is on an incredibly good path now. Her two kids are doing extremely well. One of them wants to go to Stanford University. I mean, to have that aspiration is terrific. They've got good grade point averages, and that's what it's all about. It's about the future of America as well. And Rebecca herself, she's got this great job, you know, and she's helping with customer service. And so when you call up to ask for some help from a customer service agent, just remember that there may be someone like Rebecca Hale on the other side of the line.
Yeah. The third thing that you talk about, and we're not going to talk about it right here because we have already, is jobs and retraining, and we talked about that. One other thing that you've mentioned that gives you hope is that perhaps things have gotten so bad. You cite the case of Kansas under Sam Brownback, who basically set out to test the small government philosophy. I cite the and got, you know, eventually rejected by the people of Kansas, who said, no, we want money for education. We want Medicaid. We want what the other states have. I cite the fact that teacher strikes in West Virginia and Oklahoma, you know, people would say these are not the states where teacher strikes are going to happen, but they are because things have gotten that bad.
Exactly.
Finally,
people have spoken out, and I think it's important for all legislators to listen.
Yeah. The last question I'm going to ask is, I'm going to throw you a quote that I actually read from Antoine Saint-Exupéry. I read it just after the 2016 election. And it was this: if you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood, divide the work, and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. Okay? And my question is, what do we do in 2020 to shift this story in America, this narrative?
Yeah, that's a beautiful quote. And that's really why we called it Reaching for Hope, because the most important thing is to give people hope. That is what we have discovered when we were trying to figure out, you know, is this a book? When we were traveling around the world and we saw humanitarian crises around the rest of the world, and there was one in our own backyard, and what we saw really was that millions of people in developing worlds want to come to America because they believe in the American dream. Homegrown Americans, for so many of them, they don't have hope, and so that dream is broken. And that's what we need to reinstill in people, is the idea of hope. That, and that's why I think the candidates really have to say, we are hearing you, we care about you, and we want to make life for you better. And I've seen some of it, I just don't think it's happening enough.
Yeah.
You know, the Democratic debates, they're attacking one another when they really should be saying, you know, I need to help you, you construction worker Joe, who, you know, has lost his job, or you auto worker who, GM auto worker who was laid off in the recent debacle and actually never got a job back. I want to help retrain you and help you find a new life.
Yeah, as I watch them, I often think to myself, I find that the arguing back and forth and the trying to eliminate someone else from the six that are now on the stage seems so counterproductive. It seems to me that what you want is you want to act as if, I mean, this is funny, but you want to act as if you are already president. You have already been chosen. This is what we're doing. This is where we're heading. This is, you know what I mean? And just carry that and let the others argue around you. But, you know, by the way, I don't think the moderators are any help when that comes to that.
Oh, yes.
Right.
But sometimes it's even in the way things are phrased. So, for instance, it's like, okay, on climate change, we need to get rid of coal and we need to, you know, move into renewable energy. But what does that tell the co-workers who are listening to that?
Yeah.
I mean, instead of saying it that way, it should be, you know, we want to transition from coal and we want to take those workers and retrain them.
Sure.
So that they actually be better placed to take jobs in renewable energy and become much more resilient Americans. That speaks to the voters, not just attacking another, you know, potential candidate.
Yeah, and I'm always afraid that when it becomes attacks, there's no better if you're going to play the attack game, there's no better attacker than Donald Trump. You know what I mean? That's you're playing on his turf at that point. Okay, we got to wrap it up. So again, the book is Tightrope: Americans Reaching for Hope, and I couldn't recommend it more strongly. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, you can go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. That's terrencemcnally.net or one long word, a world that just might work. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 to 10 articles that kind of flesh out the conversation, email me at temcnally@mac.com or sign up on my website. You can also subscribe and listen to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and most major podcast sites. And you'll find years of podcasts at my site and at those others. Jeremy Scahill, Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, etc. Listen anytime, anywhere. My thanks to George Vassilopoulos of Progressive Voices. Most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Cheryl Wudunn, and express my thanks again to Nick Kristof. Keep up your good work.
Thanks so much, Terrence.
If you live in Southern California, you can see the authors in person. Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudunn will be in conversation with Willow Bay Wednesday, February 26th, 7:30 p.m., downtown L.A. at the Aretani Theater, 244 South San Pedro.
For more info and to get tickets to the event, go to the site of the LA Public Library Foundation, lfla.org. That's lfla.org. Wednesday, February 26th in Los Angeles, Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn in conversation with Willow Bay, 7:30 p.m. at the Aretani Theater, downtown LA.